Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Well, of course, it's been another very busy week on the Brexit front. After securing an agreement with Brussels on Sunday, British Prime Minister Theresa May has to sell it to the House of Commons, who will vote on it on the 11th of December. Now, the battle lines are being drawn, and what does her political future hold? Does it hang in the balance? Well, Mrs. May has ruled out the possibility of holding a second referendum on Britain leaving the EU. On the line to give us her thoughts, we have a regular political analyst, Susan Phillips. Susan, good morning.
Morning, Wendy.
Okay, so what are the big updates then this week?
If you could possibly believe it, Mrs. May is now in Argentina. I mean, that poor woman, whatever people have about her policy, she is some incredible person to go after something. Anyway, she's with the G20 world leaders in Argentina, and this morning she actually took a kind of a clip, and she just said that she warned, this is what she said, she warned rebel Tory MPs that they will tear Britain apart if they vote against her Brexit deal, which is coming up in the Commons. And she went on to say, our deal is the best deal available for jobs and our economy that allows us to honour the referendum and realise the opportunities of Brexit. So, as you said, she has threatened that the alternative is a crash out, no deal. Jeremy Corbyn says he won't allow this. Brexiter Jacob Rees-Mogg complains that in the 2017 manifesto, the Conservatives said that the country would leave, and now they're not. And so you've got everybody unhappy. The ones that the Brexiters say it's not enough, and the Remainers say it's absolutely a middle-of-the-line mess. So this is the problem.
So what's going to happen next?
Well, there's the vote, you see. So the vote in the Commons is absolutely crucial. Now, every single commentator you read says that she hasn't got a hope. I totally disagree. I think she might get it through. Now, she does risk defeat, I do agree, because there are 100 Tory MPs that have already said they will vote against it. Arlene Foster's DUP MPs have indicated that they will vote it down. And as I say, many reporters say her chances are negligible. So what happens if she loses the vote and returns? Does she go back to Brussels? Does she ask for more favours? No, I don't think so. The Europeans have said they won't entertain anything more than perhaps a little cosmetic altering. So what they say is that the UK government has said that if the agreement is rejected in the Commons, Britain will leave. And this is her threat, you see, Wendy, because she's saying that if Britain just collapses out in the end of March with absolutely no deal, this is her point, there will be total chaos.
In terms of that question of there being a second referendum, what do you think the likelihood is that? Obviously, Theresa May said no chance, is there?
Well, she said that she doesn't want to do one, but then you have to look back to what we did here in Ireland with the Lisbon Treaty in 2008. People will remember that the people of Ireland voted no. We did not approve the Lisbon Treaty, which asked us, basically, would we give more of our regulations up to be affected from Brussels? Actually, most people said they hadn't the slightest clue what they were being asked. They didn't understand it, which is what you could say, Wendy, about people in Britain when they were asked, do you want to come out? Do you want to stay in? Perhaps they didn't understand it. Well, anyway,
I suppose you could say that about a lot of referendums, though, wouldn't you?
Well, the funny thing was that we have been asked twice, for Nice and again in Lisbon. So the 2008 one, people rejected it. I actually canvassed to reject it. I thought we were giving away too much. But looking back now, I think people said, look, it has to go through. You have to give back some rules. So anyway, the people of Ireland had effectively held up the whole of the EU because it had to be unanimous. And we were the only country that had a referendum because of our Article 46. So what happened? Brian Cowan said, I've gone back to Brussels. I've clarified some details. I've sorted out ethical issues and taxation and neutrality and all is well. Everybody believed him. There was a massive swing and it went through the second time. So in relation to what the question is, could the British say, could we have another referendum? Personally, nobody is pushing it, I think, because I think it would be so close again. But Jeremy Corbyn has said that if Mrs. May collapses I think it's the 11th of December, if all these hundreds that are saying saying they're not going to vote if they're going to vote against. If they do vote against her, he's saying that he probably will call for another election. He's saying that this Tory Brexit label is just an albatross around our necks for years to come. We need another government. You need us. We'll negotiate with Brussels and get a good deal for Britain. You know, everybody's muddled. You cannot say anything but everybody's muddled, because you've got Labour Brexiteers, you've got Labour Remainers, and the bottom line, Wendy, is always that all MPs look to their next election result.
That is what they're going to be thinking about, that is for sure. One of the things that I think, whether it's politicians or just ordinary people, that I think a lot of people are concerned about is, what about the financial impact of all of this? And we're already just hearing whisperings of people, you know, who are considering making investments or maybe buying a house or something like that, nervous about it, because not knowing what impact Brexit is going to have in March. And I know the Bank of England made a statement a couple of days ago. They painted a pretty bleak economic picture, didn't they?
They really did. Now, Mike Carney, of the Bank of England, he's the CEO, he just said that you're talking about absolute, I think he said, these were his words, he said that the UK could endure the worst economic shock since the Second World War if it crashes out without a deal. Now, they were pretty tough lines, and naturally, you can imagine that Jacob Rees-Mogg hopped in quickly and said, oh, the Bank of England are just perpetrating a project hysteria. You know, we've been threatened with frogs, he said, and now we're threatened with death of the firstborn. And then he said something really rude. He said, I think that this statement of the Bank of England discredits the governor, who is basically a failed second-rate Canadian politician. Now, you can't get much ruder than that, can you? Mm. I mean, there's such rudery, there's such anger. And in the end, this is just what I think could happen, that people are going to go into the House of Commons and they're going to say, we don't like it. We don't like it because it's too soft. We don't like it because it's too hard. But we actually do believe it cannot be renegotiated by March. And it's probably wiser to vote with the proposal. And then that way, perhaps in the next 2 years, all the negotiations, because don't forget, the second half of the whole exit treaty is that, yes, Britain leave, but yes, we have 2 years in which Britain can negotiate different trade agreements. And if you think about the relationship between Ireland and Britain, it's actually a very good trading relationship. I mean, it's quite unique in the sense that there's voting rights for British citizens here at some of our elections. You know, it's a different sort of agreement. And personally, I think that will hold up.
Do you think then, Susan, is it a case of, for Theresa May, just getting the UK out at all costs, even if it means for her losing her shirt, and then over time adjusting the relationship with the EU countries to suit British interests?
Well, you could say that, but she has proved to be very, very strong. She genuinely believes that, OK, this is compromise. All deals mean compromise. She really does believe that this is probably the best deal. And when you look at it, Wendy, it probably is. It's all about the backstop and the fact that Northern Ireland had to remain in the customs union, so that if some deal couldn't be done, the border would never come back. But as I've just said, if you actually look at the negotiating and the relationship between Britain trading with Ireland, it's always been a good one. So I would have thought with the future negotiations, probably there won't be any tariffs brought in, so you won't need a border. But then you've got this great thing that the Brexiteers keep saying, and they keep saying that actually no deal is the best scenario. It might be a little bit harsh, they say, but even if it was for a short period of time, wouldn't it be wonderful that Britain were now totally free of any EU sovereignty, and it would make it all worthwhile? You know, you just couldn't make it up. And Wendy, have you time to hear about the debate?
I was going to say, that's another another interesting thing about this live debate that has been mooted.
Honestly, it's so funny. Now, Mrs. May accepted the BBC's offer to host a debate. I think it was 8 p.m. on Sunday, December the 9th. However, it was immediately after Strictly Come Dancing, so I suppose that's okay, you could watch both. But Mr. Corbyn said, no, I'm not going to join you on BBC. I'd prefer to join you on ITV an hour earlier, so that we, and he said me as well, we can watch I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. And you suddenly think, what are these people doing? This is serious, mega stuff. And you're talking about not attending a debate because you want to watch some television program. It's absolutely shocking.
Well, thanks so much, Susan, for giving us those thoughts this morning. We'll chat to you again the same time next week. That's our political analyst there, Susan Phillips. Well, how good are you at handling just kind of day-to-day stress? Because we all have it every day. Do you often stop to pause, to reflect? Do you have much silence in your day? I would imagine for most of us, probably not as much as we like, or maybe we kind of set out with good intentions and they are not met often. Well, our next guest has a new book out that shows there is a way to try and shut off from this distracted world we live in through prayer and reflection. On the line to tell us more, we have best-selling author and founder of the charity Focus on Sister Stanislaus Kennedy on the phone. You know her as Sister Stan, and she has written a beautiful book called Awakening Inner Peace, A Little Book of Ours. Good morning, Sister Stan. How are you?
Good morning, Wendy. I'm good, thank you.
So first of all, did you write this book just kind of based on just yourself, or just seeing that people today were kind of just living in such a distracted world, such a world that's full of so much noise?
I suppose I wrote it because of my own need to have times of silence, you know, and inner peace in the middle of this distracted world, as you say. And I suppose if I need it, I also know that other people do. So the whole idea behind the book is to offer people an opportunity to stop, to be silent, and to get in touch with the inner peace and stop silence within them.
When you say awakening inner peace, what to you is that inner peace, and how do we awaken it?
We all have within us a deep, deep peace. Most of us don't go there. We are so busy and we live on the surface of life. So that peace is wonderful when we go there. And so this is an effort to help people to go there. And we can all go there if we just stop and just even breathe mindfully. Even to do that for a minute, 3 or 4 times a day, it would change our life. But if you try to do it, you will see, while it is very simple, it is not easy to do. So this little book, it's really based on the monastic hours. They are the hours observed by monks and nuns in what we know as enclosed orders. And they don't follow necessarily the clock hours. They follow more the rhythm of the day. And they have 8 times when they chant during the day. They, very early in the morning, they have matins before dawn, then they have lords at dawn, and they have prime later in the morning, and terse, and sect at noon, and then they have noons in the afternoon and vespers in the late afternoon and compline before they go to bed. But they have punctuated their days with times to chant. And when while I don't expect the whole world to live their lives like that, what I would like is if we did use the same concept of following the rhythm of the day rather than being tied in all the time to schedules, with no opportunity to let the mind breathe, no opportunity to be quiet within ourselves. So while it is based on the hours, and each day there are 8 hours, and there for each day of the week and for 4 weeks of the year. And there's a short, very short psalm, and then I have a little poem by myself, and then a little aspiration. So it's an opportunity for people to dip into it at any time of the day, really, and just to stop. Just the fact that we stop and breathe and reflect and enter into that inner sanctuary within us, that is a wonderful thing to do.
I have to say, I find it absolutely fascinating and wonderful that you've connected it up with and just explaining it there, just how the hours worked and that, as you say, following the rhythm of the day. And I've often thought that because, you know, talking about this time to stop, this time to be a bit more mindful, it's something that Christians have been doing through prayer and Christian meditation for many, many years. Have we forgotten that wisdom, do you think, Sister Stan?
Oh, I think we have forgotten it. I think the busyness of life sweeps us away. It's so easy to be caught up in it. So we have forgotten that time of silence and the time of to be home, at home to ourselves. I mean, I'm from near Dingle, and when I grew up, people didn't have watches. Maybe the head of the house had a watch, and there was a clock in the house. But they knew the time of day. If you met somebody in the road, you said, what time is it? They'd say, well, it's 2:45. They'd know by following the sun and the moon. They had this rhythm in their life, which was true of all rural life. Now, that rhythm is gone. So I suppose it's to help people to find a rhythm, to return to that rhythm, to come home to themselves.
How should people use this book then, Sister Stan?
They can use it really very simply to have it near the kettle or near their bed or whatever, on the breakfast table or whatever, and just open it wherever they feel drawn to. If they want to and they have the time, they could follow it each day. You take one of the hours each day and follow it in that kind of rhythm. So it's up to people themselves. All I'm asking is that people tune in to themselves, the rhythm of their life.
And I'd say it's a lovely book. I certainly would recommend, perhaps for somebody who maybe hasn't, because each page has a little bit of scripture and then a lovely reflection on it as well. And I think it's very accessible maybe to people who mightn't have prayed for some time or have just gotten out of the habit of having that silence and, as you say, kind of connecting up.
Yes.
And stopping. So it's very accessible, wouldn't you say?
I think it is. And as you say, it is open to people of different faiths and of none. It is there for everyone. It is based on the Psalms, which come from the Jewish faith. But really, I suppose, my attitude is whatever draws people to within them, they're being drawn into the divine.
Well, Sister Stan, thank you so much for joining us on the programme today and telling us about your latest book. I'm looking forward to picking it up myself today and having a bit of time to stop and awaken inner peace. I do like the sound of that. That was Sister Stan there talking to us about her new book. It's called Awakening Inner Peace, a little book of ours. Really nice book that you really can just dip in and out of, as Sister Stan said there. You know, you might pick it up when you're having a cup of tea, read a page of it, have everything off, have the phone off and just have a bit of quiet time for a bit. And you can get the book from columbabooks.com. Discussions in relation to abortion legislation have been continuing this week. And on the line to tell us a little bit more, we have independent TD Pádraig Tobin. Pádraig, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
So, Pádraig, the latest news, I believe, and I have to say I am quite shocked that there was no coverage from what I saw of this, or no intellectual rigour applied to this in the newspapers today in relation to pain relief being allowed to be given to babies who are about to be aborted. It seems in the Dáil there was no real discussion on this either.
No, the Dáil was incredibly fractious this week. I've never experienced such a level of aggression and anger. And, you know, we have people who declare themselves to be liberal, yet when asked to debate respectfully a particular issue, we were met with name-calling, our motivations were questioned all the time, and some people, their character was assassinated by people on the other side of the debate, so much so that we had Deputy Carol Nolan driven to tears on, I think it was Tuesday night, as a result of the level of aggression that was in the chamber. And then we had really kind of strange debate in which, you know, scientific facts that we put forward to the chamber, for example, with regards to abortion survivors. Some TDs said that these were fairy tales. And Lisa Chambers from Fianna Fáil stated that women who said that they had abortion regrets were, it was a making-up thing. She said, and that's a direct quote.
You wonder, did Ms. Chambers ever meet with women such as those involved with Women Hurt who speak about abortion regret courageously? Had she ever met with these women and how those women must feel hearing that said about them and their situation?
Well, it's incredible that you would have a Fianna Fáil TD basically claim that women who have expressed that they have felt abortion regret, calling them liars to a certain extent. I have met women who have suffered abortion regret, and it can be really, really difficult and really, really painful for these women. And many of those women bring that hurt with them through their whole lives. And the truth of the matter is the HSE provides post-abortion counselling. You know, the medical profession recognises that this can be a very, very traumatic experience. Peter Boylan himself, who is now a radical pro-choice or a pro-abortion campaigner, has written articles on this and stated that the regrets that people experience with regards to abortion can stay with them for their whole lives. And then we had a Fianna Fáil TD say that actually this was a making-up thing. And I was really taken aback by Fianna Fáil, especially because I was attacked very seriously by Thomas Byrne of Fianna Fáil. Now, in fairness, we had Eamon O'Queeve stood in and stated that he wanted to disassociate himself with the comments that Thomas Byrne made. But it was just really heartbreaking. Well, Thomas Byrne was saying that because of my membership of a different political organisation previously, that I was some kind of an apologist for political violence previously. And it's such a nonsense because Thomas Byrne's party asked me to join them in previous years. So if they had a problem with my analysis of the Northern conflict, surely there would have been a problem for them with regards to asking me to join them. But obviously it wasn't. They were happy enough to have me as a Fianna Fáil TD.
So rather than kind of intelligent debate, there's been a lot of mudslinging. There has been pretty much really just putting the head in the sand, is it, in relation to just like intelligently discussing some of these amendments. I think a lot of people are probably scratching their head saying, I can't think of an intelligent reason as to why you would oppose pain relief for a baby about to have their life ended.
Well, this is it. So we know from science that unborn children at the age of about 20 weeks onwards can actually feel pain, that their, you know, that their body will recoil, etc., that they have the biochemical ability to experience pain. And we know that, obviously, logic would dictate in that regards, with any shred of humanity, that you would, you know, always introduce an anaesthetic in that scenario to make sure that the unborn child didn't feel the particular pain. You would do it for a kitten, you would do it for an animal of any sort, that you would not inflict direct pain to them. And yet, the majority of Fianna Fáil TDs and Fine Gael TDs and Sinn Féin TDs all voted to prevent pain relief being added as an amendment into the legislation. And, you know, I opened up my debate and said, it is absolutely shocking that we haven't even to fight for this. That is just, you know, that we have to push the government and the main political parties just on the issue of pain relief. But all of the parties stood full square and said that they wouldn't accept pain relief. Now, the only reason that I can understand that they would not codify in the law that pain relief has to be provided to the unborn child when the unborn child is being injured is that it might reflect some level of humanity to the unborn child in the legislation. And it's very hard for them to proceed with this very radical and extreme piece of legislation if they also reflect the humanity of the unborn child. And there's a number of amendments with regards offering medical care to a child that survives abortion. And we know, again, from the Departments of Health in Canada and in Britain and in other countries, that in some occasions, not many, but some, and, you know, up to 60 a year in Britain and up to 40 a year in Canada, an unborn child can survive an abortion. And in that case, the child is no longer obviously unborn. The child is an infant. And, you know, the child is significantly injured as a result. And in those countries, those children are left to expire. And all we were asking for is they're in a hospital, they're surrounded by medics, that the medics would offer them some comfort and, if possible, save their lives. I met a woman from the States who had survived an abortion. And on her behalf, I asked the Committee on the Eighth Amendment, could she come and make a presentation about her experience to the committee? The committee said no. The chair of the committee refused to let her in. I asked another member of the Eighth Committee, was there any chance that he could push for this individual woman to make a presentation to the committee? And that individual, having gone through the whole committee experience, said, is there such thing as an abortion survivor? And so that showed you that the lack of information that the people who were making these really key decisions had when they made those particular decisions.
And it's scary.
And again, we heard from Kate O'Connell last night.
She said it was makey-uppy, and I personally have interviewed two women who have survived abortion and heard their stories, their medical records, verify their stories. It is extraordinary, isn't it? You mentioned Kate O'Connell there. I saw a clip of her where she was basically trying to change the language from that of ending the life of a fetus, which of course acknowledges the life, to ending a pregnancy. And the attitude, it seems, certainly from the Minister for Health, and I think it has flowed through from other politicians, it's almost cabal-like. There's a very petulant attitude, and it doesn't give you a lot of hope for the process.
No, Kate O'Connell wanted to debate a different bill than the bill that was in front of us. The bill in front of us was very clear. It stated in plain English that a termination of pregnancy was the ending of a life of a fetus or an unborn child. So obviously it's hard for some people to be so pro-choice and look that stark fact in the eye as well. And that's why there is a tendency amongst those on that side of the debate to seek to introduce euphemisms to cover the most difficult aspects of those particular bills. But the truth of the matter is, it is terrible language. It's shocking language. But that's why I oppose it, and that's why I voted against it at the referendum stage. And, you know, the proper response to that terrible language is not to delete the language and pretend that's not what's happening, but to actually oppose the actual operation in the first place. But we just other simple things last night. We thought that a ultrasound would be offered to a woman in advance of her decision to have an abortion. Again, because many women have abortion regrets, and many women would have said to me that they did not understand how formed the unborn child was. They didn't understand that the heart is beating, etc. And we said, like, you know, just the referendum was dressed up as choice, and all we wanted to do was offer a choice to these mothers, a choice they could accept or decline. And again, the language thrown back at us was this was some effort to control women, etc. And in a way, they always seem to introduce this really negative motivation behind our efforts in regards just simply looking to make sure that women know what's actually happening, that there is informed consent. If it was any other operation, a doctor would tell them exactly what's happening and there would be informed consent as well.
So, Padraig, what happens next in the process then?
Well, the fourth stage of the bill is not over. It's likely that it will finish Tuesday or Wednesday next week, and then it will have to go into the Senate and go through the same process as well. So it's likely that it will take 2 or 3 weeks for it to go through the Senate. Therefore, I still think it's likely that it will be complete before Christmas, but that's not a guarantee. And this government is so gung-ho on having it complete, they will probably run the debate until midnight every night before Christmas to make sure that it actually happens. For me, really, it's unlikely that there's going to be any further amendments. There's maybe one amendment that will be accepted from our side. We thought that a student would have conscientious objection. Now, it looks like the minister is going to accept that, but it's a fairly watery conscientious objection. It's not the full conscientious objection that we want, but it's a small step forward and a small win for ourselves. In my view, to be honest, this battle is going to go on in the future, and to make sure, obviously, we have some influence in this particular battle, I believe that people with a like mind have to gather around a political organization that will fight this battle. And that's why over the last number of weeks I've been involved in going around the country to attend meetings that are stuffed, standing room only meetings. Ordinary people from Fianna Fáil backgrounds, from Sinn Féin backgrounds, Labour Party backgrounds, some from Fine Gael as well, absolutely furious that the leaderships of the parties have travelled such a far distance from so many members on this particular issue. And those individuals recognise that we need to build a political party around the 32 counties of Ireland to fight this issue and other issues in the future.
Padraig, thanks so much for joining us on the programme this morning. That's Independent TD Padraig Tobin there, just giving us the latest on the discussions happening in relation to abortion legislation. Are you a parent who wouldn't dream of letting your young child watch an over-18s film at home or in the cinema? But maybe when it comes to computer games, we are a little more lax. Well, new research has found that 1/3 of 8-year-old boys are playing over-18 games with things like violent content, sexual imagery. So is it a bit of a double standard, or are parents just simply not aware of the content of the video games that their kids are playing? And I guess with Christmas a few weeks away, parents have been warned to check age restrictions on what computer and video games they allow their children to play or will be buying them as gifts. On the line to tell us more, we've Joe Kenny, founder of Zico. Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Good morning, Wendy. Thanks for having us on.
So you conducted this research. Zico conducted this research. Tell us a little bit more about it.
So what Zico does is it goes to primary schools and secondary schools across Ireland. And from September this year just to November, we surveyed just over 6,800 primary school pupils. So there's just over 3,000 boys in that sample.
So it's a very big sample size.
Yeah, it's a reasonable sample size. So today, Zico has surveyed just close on 60,000 people. And really what we're trying to achieve there is to get an objective, up-to-date insight into digital behaviours. because at SECO our mission is to create a world where young people can safely benefit from the internet and technology. So really it's we two jobs as part of that. The first one is to create awareness and to give people actionable insights. And that's why we released the kind of these statistics. And what they actually say is that 33% of second class boys and 60% of sixth class boys in primary schools access over 18's content through games.
And how are these young guys, how are they actually accessing these games? Are they being given them? Is it online or what?
So we didn't directly ask that question, but what we know from some of the other questions that we ask is that 69% of primary school boys play games consoles. So I think it will be reasonable to assume that it's through games consoles.
These are games that are bought or given or borrowed or whatever. And interestingly, boys are much more likely to play these games than girls.
Yeah, so it's actually three times more likely than girls to play these games, according to that sample of just close on 7,000 surveys.
So you might tell us, Joe, just give us some examples of some of the types of video games that eight-year-olds are playing and the content that's in them.
So we didn't actually directly ask that question, but anecdotally we know that they're games that contain violence or have a sexual content. So there's some really great resources out there for parents. So there's a thing called the Pan-European Games Info. It's called PEGI rating. So it's similar to the rating system on movies for, you know, over 18 content. And then there's some other great websites. For example, one is called the Entertainment Software Review Board. And the website for that is esrb.org. And what that does is if somebody's wants to find out the content of a game, there's a quick description or a summary of the content of each game.
Okay, which is good for obviously knowing if a game is suitable, but also, I mean, at the end of the day, if kids are enjoying these games, and obviously it has to be in moderation, because I'd imagine perhaps a lot of children, even just looking at a story today in relation to childhood obesity and sedentary lifestyles, are probably playing a lot of these games for too long anyway. But still, there needs to be somewhere parents can go to find a games that are suitable, an alternative.
Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting point, Wendy. So, like, in that survey, we found out that 15% of primary school children spend between 1 to 3 hours per weekday online, and that at the weekend, interestingly, 16% of primary school children spend greater than 5 hours per day online. And so you're absolutely right. So I think it's about being online and the use of technologies around balance. So what we say in Zika, we're trying to help people to safely benefit. So we're not saying to people that the internet or technology is bad, but what we are saying to people is that there are certain elements of technology and the internet where there are risks, which we need to reduce. But on the other side, there's positives of the internet. So it's an integral part of young people's lives. It's where they form relationships. It's where they find information. And so we need to help young people to safely benefit. So for those positives, we need to extenuate them. So show them how to use them responsibly. And so the point being is it's around balance. And the other word you said was sedentary lifestyle. You're absolutely right. So where people spend too much time online, it's the indirect effect of that, which essentially means if they're spending too much time online, they're not getting enough exercise. And the implications of that for their physical health as well as their mental health are quite significant.
And the impacts on that are just absolutely huge. In terms of going back to the video games, Joe, do you think when it comes to parents, are they just not aware of the content? And you know, in a way, maybe the fact that we have the research now does it kind of empower us to kind of be able to take practical steps. But I certainly know I got my hands on, I was obviously bucking the trend because I got my hands on, I think it was called Grand Theft Auto, certainly before I was under 18. And to be honest, I wouldn't even want an over 18. I wouldn't want anybody playing the game. The content in it was so bad and all that sort of stuff. But our parents just not aware.
So anecdotally, I think that would be the case. So parents today, when they were playing video games, I suspect there were things like Space Invaders and Pac-Man. And so games like Grand Theft Auto, which you mentioned, they're totally different games. So they're different content. The graphics are far superior. And we know anecdotally, so we would speak to about thousands of parents each year, hundreds each week, in schools across Ireland, and anecdotally we would know that parents wouldn't be aware of the content.
OK, Okay, so it really is about parents. We have to take responsibility ultimately. I think probably one of the things that happens to parents, and I can understand it, Joe, is that it's such a rapid change. I know that that same research that you found that the average age that children start accessing the internet is between 6 and 7, and primary school children are spending between 1 to 3 hours per day online. It's a huge amount of time, especially when we think of the internet. And as you said, and it's not a bit scaremonger because there's so much that's positive, but you still kind of think a six-year-old spending that amount of time online, it can't be good.
Yeah, so I think it's really about balance with the kids. It's like anything in life. So I like chocolate, right? So too much chocolate isn't good for me, and too little chocolate isn't good for me either because I like it. And so it's about balance. And so it's about balancing for young people and people in general to balance their offline lives with their online lives.
Yeah, and I'm really just kind of making that at the fore. Well, what would be your advice to parents, especially now? I'm thinking of the Christmas period, you know, you got kids going to be off school on their holidays, and, you know, parents trying their best to try and obviously get rid of, now that maybe there's more awareness, get rid of games that are unsuitable, but also even just trying to cut down on the time that maybe kids are on the internet or indeed playing video games. What's your advice there, Joe?
It's a really good question. I think it's really to set up a family media plan. So before we introduce, let's say, content or technology into our houses, what we should do is agree a family media plan. So how are we going to use that technology? And then the other thing that I would say to parents is around communication. So one of your points, Wendy, was around the rate of change of innovation is increasing so much. So it is really difficult to keep up for everybody. But one of the real tricks is around open communication for people to engage with their young people through active mediation to understand what they're doing online and to work through those technological and human challenges together to find solutions and not to make our young people defensive. We know that parents are overwhelmed. That's why they come to hear Zico talk in schools across Ireland every day of the week. And really it's to say to parents, this isn't a technology problem, but it's a human behaviour problem.
And it's communication that we need to be having with our kids.
Totally.
Yeah, really good advice, Joe. Thanks so much for joining us on the programme this morning.
Thank you, Joe Kenny, Wendy.
There of Zico. By the way, if you're interested in just checking out that full piece of research, you can go to Zico's website, zico.ie. And the website that Joe mentioned earlier on in the chat in relation to the PEGI rating, which is similar to the rating that we have on films, but it's for video games, you can get it on the website pegi.info. That is the Pan-European Games Information website there. Well, earlier on in the week, we were chatting to Niamh Daly of Tear Fund, where she talked a little bit about the current situation in Yemen. It has been deteriorating as fighting escalates in this 3-year civil war. A lot now regard this as a proxy war involving the likes of Saudi Arabia and Iran. International non-profit organisation Medicine Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, has expressed growing concern for its patients and staff threatened by fighting very close to its facilities in one of the 4th largest cities in Yemen and its principal port in the Red Sea as well. Online to give us an update on the current situation on the ground, we have Sam Taylor, Director of MSF Ireland. Sam, good morning to you.
Morning, Wendy.
Tell us a little bit about the work that MSF is doing in Yemen.
So MSF has been present in Yemen for many years, and obviously since the conflict started nearly 4 years ago, we have increased our presence on the ground. We run a number of facilities directly ourselves, but we also support a lot of facilities that are run by Yemeni health staff. And yeah, we're seeing, as you mentioned in the intro, we're seeing extremely worrying positioning at the moment around the medical facilities we run in Hodeidah, where there's fighting very close to the medical facilities, and civilians and the rights of civilians are unfortunately not being respected, which is something we're seeing across the conflict in Yemen, with all parties to the conflict, unfortunately.
In terms of them, just really trying to paint the picture of the challenges that people are facing in Yemen, Sam, because, you know, I think for a lot of people listening, they will have seen just really heart-wrenching images of small children who are skin and bone. But I think, sadly, what sometimes happens is people almost in a way become immune to the just daily realities and just for how long this has been going on for.
Absolutely. And you know, those striking images, clearly they're very real, but they only show kind of one part of the conflict. I think you know, when we talk to our Yemeni colleagues who work for the health authorities, they've not been paid for nearly 2 years. Could you imagine, you know, HSE staff who've not been paid yet continue to come to work? There are very significant issues around food insecurity and inflation and people just not being able to afford to live. I mean, I don't know if you saw the story recently about the young child that died because their parents, we actually had a hospital only 15 kilometers away from that village, but the parents couldn't afford the transportation. So it's a really grim situation. And yeah, I mean, people do get immune, get, you know, if they keep being exposed to these things. But, you know, from our side as Médecins Sans Frontières, between the international staff, including Irish staff that we have on the ground and our national staff, you know, we can't but try and flag as much attention as is possible to the horrific situation there, where, you know, just an example, something that we face on an unfortunately regular basis is the targeting and the striking of medical facilities by airstrikes, which is, you know, it's against all the rules of war, against the Geneva Conventions, but it's something that we see with dismaying regularity.
How is that continuing to happen?
I mean, it's something that we try and prevent. We share details with all parties to the conflict, but it's something that is not just in Yemen. I was working on the Syria crisis for 2 years, and the deliberate targeting of medical facilities, despite its completely illegal nature, is something that we're seeing as being used as a tactic of the conflict, is to deprive support to one of the parties to the conflict. To, you know, a hospital should be a safe space, but if people feel that it's not, then they won't go and seek healthcare there, which is, you know, is a basic right for everybody.
I know one of the parts of the work that MSF teams are doing, Sam, is treating people, civilians who are wounded by the conflict.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we treat war wounded, we treat malnutrition, and one of the forgotten parts of the health implications of conflicts like this are that, you know, very simple things like vaccines get interrupted. So when you start to get to the longer conflicts like we're seeing now in Yemen, like we've seen in Syria, you're having a whole generation of kids who are growing up without the basic vaccinations that they need, which has obviously very serious long-term implications for their health. But it's, you know, it's a whole package of care that's needed. The health system has collapsed entirely inside Yemen. I mean, I don't know if it was a particularly strong health system before the conflict, but it's very challenging now. And I know that, you know, even for relatively basic stuff like heart disease and chronic diseases, this is something that you know, these diseases that in outside of conflict are very manageable. I've asked them myself, it's easy to manage. But when you have these diseases, these non-communicable diseases in a conflict, if your treatment's interrupted, then they become fatal. And you know, I remember my time on the Syria crisis, and it's similar with Yemen. You know, if you get killed because you can't get your heart meds, it's just as tragic for your family as if you get killed by a bullet.
You're still gone at the end of the day. In terms of a ceasefire, is there any hope of that happening, Sam?
I mean, it's, you know, we're not a political organization, and we negotiate with every political party, but, you know, we're optimistic. The only solution to this is a political solution. So we're desperately hoping that might be the case. But from what we're seeing on the ground, I mean, it's not going in that direction at the moment.
In terms of for people listening and what they can do, what is the best way that people can actually do something about what's going on in Yemen?
I mean, what I would do if I wanted to help people in Yemen, I'd look for independent organizations who are running operations directly themselves on the ground, as MSF is. If they choose to support MSF, they can go to msf.ie. We have a Yemen appeal currently running. We had an Irish field staff member recently back in the office, and he was briefing us about it. And, you know, we're using that opportunity to try and raise some attention about it. But, yeah, you know, like MSF, we're independent of all the political parties. We're independent of all religious groups. We ensure that the money that gets donated here in Ireland gets where it's supposed to get to.
Yeah, because I think there is a worry there, isn't it? There has been stories in the last number of years of money not getting where it's meant to get to. So that is a concern that people can have, you know, wanting to make sure that it gets to where it needs to go. In terms of just, obviously, you've painted a picture, Sam, of how serious the humanitarian situation is. Would you say it's kind of one of the most serious at the moment?
To, To be honest, in MSF, we don't tend to do those kind of rankings because for all the pain and suffering that exists currently in Yemen, there are places that are unfortunately not in the media spotlight where things are drastically bad as well. Yeah. The Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic, these are places that unfortunately don't get media coverage. But I think we can say without ranking it that it's an extremely grave humanitarian situation that should be addressed as a matter of urgency. And one of the things that we were calling for when our Irish colleague was back talking to the Irish government here, for example, was a significant upscaling of large-scale humanitarian funding is needed. Rather ironically, 70% of the funding that goes into humanitarian action inside Yemen is donated by people who are also bombing in the country. So you can imagine there are some conflicts of interest there where the Saudi and Emirati-led coalition is pumping in millions of dollars, but at the same time dropping bombs it highlights the need for independent medical humanitarian action.
Yeah, and just the courageous work of doctors, as you have mentioned, and other medics, which, you know, they're giving up a portion of their life when they could be, I imagine, making lots of money in a hospital somewhere else in the world. It's truly incredible.
That's absolutely true. But I mean, one thing I'm always keen to get across is that the doctors and nurses and logisticians and administrators that we send here from Ireland and the international staff that MSF has are only 10% of the workforce. The backbone of MSF are the Yemeni staff in Yemen, are the Somali staff in Somalia. They're the ones, unfortunately, who are in an even harder position in that they cannot leave. So I always like to, you know, when people make a donation to MSF, they're not just paying for the staff to go from Dublin, from London, from wherever, but they're also paying for the 90% of MSF staff who are from the countries where we're working.
That's a very important point that you've made there and one that a lot of people mightn't be aware of, Sam. Thanks for chatting to us this morning. That's Sam Taylor, the Director of MSF Ireland. So my next guest hails from County Derry. She has critically acclaimed music and has seen her win things like Meteor Music Awards for Best Irish Female, along with the Album of the Year at the BBC Two Radio Folk Awards. And she's performed at concert halls and festivals all over the world. And she's setting out for a Christmas tour on the line to tell us a little bit more. We have musician Cara Dillon. Cara, morning to you.
Good morning.
Now tell us a little bit about yourself and your history and career so far in the music industry. You were very young when you started. You were signed at 19, weren't you?
Yeah, signed to Warner Music when I was 19. And I was in a band with my husband now and his two brothers, the Lakemans. And it was very exciting at that age to be signed and with a 5-album deal. But, you know, things just developed at a different pace. And a few years later, myself and Sam Lakeman left that band and got re-signed to Rough Trade. And we made a couple of records there, and then we broke away. We just decided, you know what, we've been involved with too many big record labels, and we want to have a go at doing it ourselves. We had seen how it all operates, and so we broke away and just did our first album. And it was a big decision for us because, you know, we were wondering if we were doing the right thing, and people were saying you're crazy. And actually, that was the start of it for us. Really, we recorded our first album in a small tiny room in Sam's parents' house, and we went on to win lots of awards with that album, and it sort of set us up as artists that people started taking seriously, and we haven't looked back.
It's amazing just to see that kind of journey of kind of going from different labels and then to independent. So you obviously like kind of working independently now.
Yes, we decided to then take it a step further. A few years ago, we set up our own record label, Charcoal Records, and have been releasing our albums on it since. And, you know, it's been such a revelation, and I just felt, you know, we kind of knew what we were doing, and we always felt compromised with the bigger labels because they're always looking for something that's maybe a bit more commercial, and we felt, you know what, we're going to just trust our instincts, and we're going to do the music that we know and that we love, and if we love it, somebody else will love it out there. And it's been, you know, we've never looked back. It's been the best thing we've ever done.
And I'd imagine, Cara, it also gave you a bit more freedom. I know that you have beautiful twins, but they were born a little bit early at 26 weeks. How are they doing?
They are amazing. So they were born in 2006, and they were born at 26 weeks and had a lot of problems. And it was very, very complicated and very, very stressful and traumatic. But, you know, they started secondary school there in September,
wow.
and they're 12, and they're the same height as me now, and they're strong and healthy and well and gorgeous. So I'm so blessed to have them in my life, and there's not, I suppose, if there's anybody out there who's ever been through that whole premature baby trauma, there, you realise there's not one single day goes past in your life where you don't look at them and just go, oh, oh my God, I love them, and I'm so grateful that they're okay. So, yeah, I'm very, very lucky.
And it's incredible, really. There was news here the other week of one of our hospitals, the Rotunda, having 100% survival rate for babies born at around,
wow.
around that stage, which was just truly incredible. Just the advances in,
that's
in medicine.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so it was amazing. To mark World Prematurity Day, they were releasing this piece of research. So you're kept busy between the kids and the music. So tell us a little bit about the upcoming Christmas tour then, Cara.
Yes, so we... tonight is the start of a 17-day tour, and I wanted to start the tour this year in Ireland because, you know, there's just something about you feel really comfortable and confident amongst your own. and I said to the lads in the band, we're starting it in Ireland this year. And so tonight we're in the Millennium Forum in Derry, and then tomorrow night we're going to be in Dunleary, and then Ulster Hall in Belfast. And then we'll be heading over to England, and we've got the rest of the tour there. And this is our third year doing this Upon a Winter's Night tour. We released the album 3 years ago. I wanted to make a Christmas album. And I suppose it was quite selfish. I wanted to make an album for my children. I've got a little girl too, who's 8. And I wanted them to hear Christmas music that wasn't just like Jingle Bells and Santa Baby and all that. I wanted them to know that there's beautiful music out there that captures the magic and the reverence of Christmas. And so I made this album for them, and you know, it just took wings. And as I say, this is our third year touring it, and none of us could have predicted how successful it would be. It's kind of become a bit of a tradition now. A lot of the gigs have sold out, and a lot of people have been saying, you know, writing us messages and sending us messages on Facebook and saying, you know, it's definitely something they like to do as a family now, and it's definitely, you know, it's a bit different to everything else that's out there. So I feel really lucky because I love Christmas. We all do in our family, and I just love the fact that I can celebrate Christmas now for the next, right up to the end of December from tonight.
You can keep singing about it, and it's lovely to hear that it's a nice kind of Christmas tradition that families can do together. For someone who hasn't been to one of these concerts before, Cara, what can they expect from the night?
Well, there'll be 6 of us on stage, and Sam, my husband, he plays a piano and guitar, and we've got a wonderful box player, Luke Daniels, and a multi-instrumentalist playing fiddle and whistle called Toby Scheer, and Ed Boyd from Fluke, guitarist from Fluke, and we've got wonderful lights, and we've designed these beautiful Christmas trees out of wood, and the whole scene is just so magical. But I think, you know, there's just... it's a very special concert. It's there's a lot of light and shade, and there's a lot of very traditional carols like O Holy Night and things like that, and O Come Emmanuel. But in amongst that, there's a couple that we've written ourselves. There's one in particular, my favourite, it's called Mother Mary, and our three children sing on the album. And it's I wanted to write a song from the point of view of a mother, you know, Mary, whenever she had this baby, and how everybody was expecting so much of this baby, and at the end of the day, it's her baby. And we all know, if you're a mother out there, how overwhelming it can be when you have a baby, and everybody wants to have it, and everybody wants the cuddle and all. But, you know, so imagine being the mother of Jesus, and everybody expecting him to save the world. So it's from her point of view. So there's a lot of light and shade. It's very special.
Well, really, really, the music seems to, as you mentioned, Cara, just try to reflect on the real meaning of Christmas and get away from that kind of the more commercial stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, you know, like, I love all that other type of music too, of course, you know, and there's something great about going out into a shopping mall and hearing, you know, Mariah Carey's version of Santa Baby or whatever. But I think, you know what, it's really important to have the little nod towards the proper true meaning of Christmas. You know, I think it's beautiful, and It's got a place, you know.
It sure does. Cara, it sounds like you're going to have a wonderful 17 gigs and helping lots of people get into the spirit of Christmas. Thanks so much for joining us on the programme this morning. That's Cara Dillon there. And as Cara mentioned, she's going to be playing tonight in the Millennium Forum in Derry. Tomorrow, that's Saturday the 1st of December, in the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary in South County Dublin. On the 2nd of December, the Ulster Hall in Belfast. And then she's moving on to the UK. You can get all the details on caradillon.co.uk.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.